Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And if you're a guitar player who's looking to make some more money, then listen very closely to what I'm about to tell you. If you're a guitar player or any other kind of musician for that matter, or if you know a musician who wants to make some more money without having to tour or go on the road or put up with any of the other BS musicians normally have to deal with, then you need to download this new special report about how to make a small fortune by licensing your music. And by licensing music, I mean getting your music inserted into movies, television shows, and commercials. The report is less than 20 pages long, and it was written by Mike Elsner, who I interviewed in episode number 167 of this show. Mike's been doing this for over 14 years, and he's had over 2,000 songs licensed at this point in time. That means he's getting paid to license almost 150 songs per year. Now keep in mind, most successful career musicians don't get paid for 150 songs in total over a 30 or 40 year career. Yet Mike's getting paid for this on an annual basis. And the cool thing about this business is that you can run it from your own home studio and you'll never have to deal with ivory tower record label executives telling you what to play and how to play it, and no shady managers or unethical business people telling you what to do either. So download Mike's free ebook on the four-step plan to licensing success right now. Just go to everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/Mike, M-I-K-E. Let me know how you like the book, and now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and it's my mission to get every professional guitar player in the Bronx on this show. And today, we have the second of three of them. And I don't know who the third is, but I'm thinking we'll find him somehow. Anyway, we got Gil Paris here. Gil's a Grammy-nominated guitar virtuoso. He's known for a special blend of blues, jazz, rock, and smooth jazz. He's recorded and toured both as a solo artist and sideman with major artists like Dr. John, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Diane Schur, Bobby Caldwell, and Tony Braxton, just name a few. He's released 7 solo CDs. He's been seen on NBC's The Today Show, CBS, WPIX, Fox 5, BET Studio Jams, The Yes Network, The Food Network, and on national DVD release, Masters of the Stratocaster. He's a Hot Licks artist video and the first True Fire artist course, Inside Out. He's got a Gil Paris model signature guitar by Reverend. It was named one of the coolest artist signature guitars of all time by Guitar Player magazine, and they're actually coming out with a second version of that guitar this summer. He's got an acclaimed DVD out right now with Paul Schaefer, Bernie Williams from the Yankees, Randy Brecker, and David Mann, and it's hosted by Carolyn Kepcher. Gil, thanks for your time. I know you're busy. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Craig.
We also had a technological summit before the show. Hey man, congratulations on your signature guitar. How did that come about?
Well, I did a show. I was doing these all-star guitar nights. Muriel Anderson put them together. And back in 2007, I was out there at NAMM. And I did a couple tunes, and it was a special night, and there was great energy, and I lucked out. I got a standing ovation, and right after that, I went out to dinner with the guys from Reverend, and Joe Naylor said, "Hey, I want to do a signature model with you." So it was really Joe, who was the owner of the company at the time, and he presented that to me, and it's over a decade now.
That's so awesome. And it's to have a signature guitar model, it's still active 10 years later, and now they're coming out with a second one. This says a lot about the guitar.
Yeah, it's great. The nice thing about it, it's very versatile, and it sales picked up right away. So, and I worked out a great deal with them, and I'm really happy about it. It's gone through a couple reincarnations, and I like the pickup configuration, so I'm very proud of it. And Guitar Player gave it an award, which was great.
What is the pickup configuration in it?
I have 2 humbuckers and a single coil in the middle, and there's like a bass contour, so you can kind of get like Tele sounds, Strat sounds, and Les Paul sounds. It's, you know, very all over the map.
Very cool, man. When you get a signature guitar with these guys, do they like, literally you work on every single detail, like measuring up specs of, you know, thicknesses and wood type?
Yes. No, we went through a couple. I'm actually looking at the first prototype they did for me, which is right here. But yeah, we went through a couple different things, that I liked and didn't like, but certain things, I had a rose on my old Strat, and, you know, we were talking about putting that on, but it's too specific, you know, and, which they were right. Everything kind of worked out for the best.
I've seen that Strat in YouTube videos.
Yeah.
It's very cool looking. Hey, for each of these artists, I want to just talk about a couple of artists that you worked with. If you could talk about how you got the gig and the nature of the engagement, and maybe a cool or interesting story about working with them, and if there's any takeaways that you got out of it, whether it's things that you learned about business, entertainment, playing, any aspect, if you did in fact get anything like that. And the first one is Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
I mean that's a huge question, because I take something away from every sideman gig. The thing with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, I got the call in 2000, and I was signed to RCA BMG as a solo artist. So I really didn't want to do any sideman work. And then the business started to change, and I ended up calling them back and saying, you know what, I want to do it. And David Clayton Thomas was the singer.
Wow.
And we were, yeah, it was great. So, and I was with them about a year and a half, and Phil Magalanes, the keyboard player, recommended me, and Lou Soloff, rest in peace, put in a good word. And so I never really auditioned. I was doing some pro work, and he had heard the recordings, and, just kind of, worked out. And David was very happy. I did an interview for the New York Times where he said some really nice stuff about how I made the gig my own and stuff. And it was a good time.
What was it like? Like, that guy's voice is so iconic and so, it's very unique. He doesn't, it's like when you hear him sing, it's no mistake. You know right away who it is. It's like listening to Paul Rodgers, it's Paul Rodgers. What was it like the first time you're playing and you hear that? Like, was it kind of weird?
It was. See, I love that. That's why I kind of feel like, since he retired from the band, it's not the same. It's just not. Something is really missing. And I remember our first gig was like some kind of crazy amount of people. It was like a rib fest, and I can't remember. There were a couple acts, I think Frampton, and there were like 50,000 people there. And I remember looking up on the big screen, and first gig, his voice was something, and we got along well. It's tough traveling with somebody, all the time. And there was 1 month where we had like 43 flights in 1 month. So you can,
that's enough to make, that makes you cranky regardless. But when you add that you're traveling with somebody, it's not, it's even harder. Yeah. How about Dr. John, another like iconic voice player guy, just musician?
Well, I never had the gig with Dr. John. I recorded with him with a band back in, I think it was 93. And there's a version of us doing Ain't No Sunshine on a record called Syndicate of Soul, which was on Shaanxi. And it's funny, I go back and listen to it, and I'm like, wow, I was so young, but I'm really proud about it. And from there, we did some one-offs. There's some videos of us at BB King's and stuff, but he's an incredible artist, and he's able to fit his thing in so many different genres, which is very, that's one thing I look for in artists, where like somebody like a David Sanborn or like a Larry Carlton, where they can fit what they do in different genres and still retain their personality.
You're kind of like that. You're really diverse. You do a lot of different things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a gift musically, kind of a curse in some ways career-wise, because now especially now with branding and stuff, the attention span of the public is so short. It's like they want to know exactly what you are and what you do. And with me, it's kind of all about phrasing and music for me. Like I don't pick and choose. You know, if I'm laying what I do over, you know, a smooth groove or a straight ahead thing or a Latin thing or a blues gig, it's still music to me. I kind of think in the same way, you know.
Yeah, that guy I was telling you about, that session player interviewed yesterday, he mentioned the same thing about phrasing, how that's what's the most important thing to him as well. And he talked about guys like Clapton and you know, just certain people that are known for their phrasing in that.
Yeah, it's the most misunderstood aspect of music, and I think it's the most important. So it's really a funny thing. I think I'm going to do some instructional stuff just talking about that coming up in the future, because it really, you know, that's kind of what I do.
Yeah, man, I think that would actually be a good topic, because I think every player is aware of phrasing, but I don't think nobody's from a teaching or tutorial standpoint, not many people are discussing that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
I know you work a lot as a working musician. Is there anything particular you're working on now that you're excited about?
Yeah, there are three projects now that I'm kind of doing simultaneously, and one of them is the band with Bernie Williams, where and he's gracious enough to give me co-host, the Bernie Williams Gil Parris Quartet, and we call it Jam Family, and we've been doing a lot of gigs together. We did Gitano, Infinity Hall, Daryl's House. We do a big show at NAMM every year. Did like 7 years of that, and
out in Cali.
Yeah,
you were out there. Yep. This year did that.
Yeah.
Oh, cool, man.
I mean, it was so heavily attended. It was it's always like a big thing when we do that, and we're gonna record it. It's I did a lot of arrangements of some classic tunes. We're doing some writing. I arranged a lot of TV show themes for like Blowing and stuff, and it's really fun.
So you're going to go and put a record together?
Yeah, I want to do it live. We've been talking about, you know, like maybe Daryl's House or something, kind of tracking it for a couple of days. But we're very good friends, so it's going to happen.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that'd be, you know, I think that's a nice, you know, in today's day and age where putting out a record is like, it's almost like why?
Right.
You know, like, okay, you know, but I think a live thing is kind of cool, especially at a place like Daryl, that at least they have the acoustics and the recording and everything is down there. And you'll have a great crowd that's really into the music there at that place. You know, it's just a good place to see.
I just played there last month. So, yeah, I know it's they have it together and it sounds great.
Yeah, for sure, man. Well, I wish you a lot of luck with that.
Thank you.
You said three projects. So that's one, Bernie Williams, Gil Parris.
Yeah. The other one, I do this show called Picks the Guitar Hits, which is it's the music of Hendrix, Santana, Beck, blues, and beyond. And what I do is I take these, like I'll take a song like Crosstown Traffic and I'll make a soul jazz arrangement out of it. I'll change the harmonies to like Europa. And so people come and they know the material, but I'm really putting my slant on it, which, you know, I finally feel after 40 plus years of playing like I can interpret these tunes in my way and the audience digs it. And I feel like it's a personal artistic thing, you know, and I'm really proud of it. It's doing really well. We sold out B.B. King's, the main room. I have a whole weekend at Iridium coming up in July.
That's awesome, man. Shit, yeah. I'm going to be in this. I know you're not going to be there when I'm in the city, but I'd love to see you do that show. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's really fun. So, and you know, people come out and they say, hey, you know, can you do Freeway Jam? Can you do, you know, and I make little notes if I can't do it that time. You know, we're doing Two Rolling Stone by Robin Trower.
What an amazing song. It's hard. That's such a good song, man.
Yeah, so it's good. And the band's great. So, and I add male and female vocals on a few tunes, and that's getting into the third project, which my girlfriend's a young singer that even though she's young, she's really into stuff like Randy Crawford and Carly Simon, and she's got a really pleasing tone, and I'm kind of writing stuff for her, and she's headlining venues, which it's really nice to see, and it's fun to hear it come together. Yeah,
it's cool, man. Where is she playing?
Well, we have she's doing Women's History. Women's History Month.
Right, I saw that on your Facebook.
Which is when are we doing that? St. Patrick's Day, actually, at Iridium. We're headlining.
Very cool, man.
So she's headlining. I'm just the guest.
That's okay, man. That's all. Keep it all in the family, you know. It's all good, man. That's really cool. You know what? I think I saw Les Paul play there once. Long time ago, but I don't know that I've been there in ages.
It's great. It's definitely, I've played all of the places, Blue Note, and it's definitely one of the best clubs in the city, without a doubt. So happy to play there.
Has the percentage or the number of clubs that are around decreased?
Yes, a lot. No doubt about it. Yeah, especially with the rents going up, the nook and cranny places where, like, there was a place we used to play at called Metropolitan, which was booked by Joe Caro, the studio guitar player. His wife booked it, and it was such a great scene. I mean, every Tuesday night, you'd see Hugh McCracken, Hiram Bullock would hang. God, I played there with everybody. Will Lee, Keith Carlock, David Mann. It was a great scene. And every Tuesday was packed with A-list guys. So, but those kind of nook and cranny places are gone. They're like drying up. So it has to be sort of like the bigger known venues now. And it's a shame because it's like I like old New York. Where,
oh, yeah. Well, like the bottom line is gone, isn't it?
Yeah, you know that's what I mean? Gone.
The Ritz is gone.
Yeah,
I mean, those are pretty established big places.
But I mean, I'm talking about there were places like Decade, and I'm trying to think of God, I used to like just go into bars and see like Jimmy Vivino somewhere after the show, and just, you know, he'd hand me a guitar and we'd jam out, and Jeff Golub, and you know, there were always like little nook and cranny hangs where. Yeah. Would be word of mouth, and you know, actors would be hanging out, and guys coming off shoots, and that kind of thing is kind of drying up.
Primarily because the rent, you think?
Yeah,
it's crazy, isn't it?
It is. Yep.
It's really weird because I you know, I loved spending time in the Village my whole childhood, and I go back there now, and it's kind of disappointing, to be honest. It's not like. The whole vibe was like bohemian, eclectic, artsy. Just now it's like fucking Stumptown, Starbucks,
Dwayne Reed. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, 15 shoe stores where they start selling shoes at like $500. I'm like, who the hell's.
Yeah.
And there's nobody in any of them. And I'm like, you know, it's just a rotating cavalcade of, you know, next 6 months later, it'll be a high-end leather store where no one's going to go in there. It's just
there are a few really places, though. There's like Fat Cat where they have like, you know, jazz and ping pong. And there's Arthur's Tavern around the corner. There are still places, you know. But it's not as, it's not quite the way it was. But, you know, the whole business isn't the way it was. So.
Very true. Very true, man. You've been doing this a long time, and I was curious, what would you say your top three musical experiences are that the three experiences you had that either left you feeling great about the work you did or the, you know, the project as a whole and most rewarding to you? What would you say your top three musical experiences are?
All right. You know, if they always say it's like the first time is the sweetest. So I guess it was the first time I sent in on cassette to Mike Varney. I sent him to get into Spotlight and Guitar Player. And that was, he called me on the phone. I remember being at home, you know, and this was 1990, and he said, I'm putting you in the magazine, and, you know, blah, 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 and you're doing great things. And that, I remember, like, breaking down and crying. I was so touched. And
that's awesome.
Back, Yeah, it really, like, that always stuck with me because so many great players were in there after and before Paul Gilbert and Frank Abali and Scott Henderson, and I'm probably leaving out dozens, but and he stayed in touch. And from there, back then, back in 1990, when you were in a magazine like that, it really was like a big deal. Like, I had people recognize me at Sam Ash and stuff. You know, it was just this little thing. Now, you know, print is kind of dying. So
yeah, you know, because there was so few sources of information. So the few that were out there were like drenched, you know, like milked dry by every single player.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, now there's an infinite number of sources, so it's like the any one of them has been diluted. The value of them have all been diluted.
It
makes a lot of sense.
This also, when this came out, can you see this?
Yeah, man, what is it? The VHS.
Yes, it's
Gil Parris, Modern Blues Guitar.
That's right.
Hot Lick. Awesome, man. Arlen Roth. Yeah.
Yes, so that I'm really proud about. Actually, I heard Hal Leonard is releasing that catalog on digital download coming up soon, so I'm happy about that. So
he's got hundreds. I just happened to speak to him like last week. He's got literally hundreds. He was telling me there's like 500. Just some mass. I don't think it's 500, but there's a massive number of those out there. And you know, you think about how he did it with tape. And where you really had to labor over each one to have done
well,
that.
Well, he
many.
Loved it. I mean, I remember coming from the airport. We were editing, and we would just get like Greek salad and spinach pie and sit there for hours. And you know, it was a labor of love for him. And we had a great time together. He's awesome. So I'm proud of that. I mean, being signed to RCA BMG, that was like, you know, Chet Atkins' label, Elvis's label. That's, you know, pinch me. Those were good years, you know.
And you had a handler.
Yeah, right, exactly, which I really need today. Mm-hmm.
Hey, where in the Bronx did you grow up, and what was your childhood like?
I was born in Jacoby in the Bronx, and then I lived in the Village. We had an apartment. It was my grandparents' apartment, and I ended up moving up to Yonkers, and then I went to Ardsley High School, which is a little town about half an hour, maybe 40 minutes from Midtown, which is great.
Yeah.
And it's, it was great because we still kept until my grandparents passed away. We had to give up the apartment, but St. Mark's and First rent controlled.
Holy crap.
Yeah. I don't.
Wow, what a cool location, man. You're right in the heart. That was when the Lower East Side had, character.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It was really cool. It was gritty as shit, but it was really cool. It was a great place to just experience life. There was so much energy there.
Yeah, I used to go and I hang with everybody. I would go see Mike Stern like every Wednesday. And then I ended up being like a sub there on Monday and Wednesdays when he was out of town at the 55. Was great. But I lost the place in 2001. So,
you couldn't keep it because of
that. Nah, couldn't do it. It was like before parchment. I didn't have anything, you know, it was family so long. But we enjoyed it.
Very cool, man. What kind of work did your folks do?
My father was a stage actor, a Broadway and off-Broadway, and tour. Yeah, he just passed away in September, and
sorry about that.
He was awesome. Thank you.
Real sorry,
thank you. But and my mother was a speech pathologist. But they were very artistic people and big supporters. So I was around the show business thing my whole, you know, I didn't even think about it until later. You know, I saw my dad with Mickey Rooney. I saw him with Danny DeVito and Estelle Getty in these plays. I would go to all these little plays and I'd be like, you know, later on it hit me. I was like, wow, this is really part of who I am. You know, the whole showbiz thing.
So it's really cool. I think it's great. So they were very accommodating and encouraging, I would imagine, excuse me, your career.
Yeah. It's, you know, I was lucky to have success fairly early. So they were able to catch, you know, a lot of cool things, like, you know, being on the Today Show as an artist and being in front of big audiences and stuff. And they would come out and as I would go to see him as well. So it was really fun, you know.
That's great, man. Really cool. So you basically, there was no, you just knew you were going to play guitar. This is what you know, it was like the family business kind of.
Yeah, I my first lesson was, I think, eight or nine. And, I was hooked after the first lesson. So, I was kind of inclined to do it. I was studying with another guy, and I always seemed to excel quicker. And after a couple of weeks, he said, listen, we got to break you guys up. And then, you know, that kind of kept happening to me. And I worked hard, too. I just really enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of times, you know, I talk to people. I think the perception is, you know, you hear people make comments sometimes, oh, he's a natural. But, you know, it's a lot of work. It's not like he's a natural and, you know, you fog a mirror. You still had to do the work. It may have come easier and more naturally, and you had a talent for it, and you were excelling quicker. But I don't think people understand how difficult it is to become excellent in anything oftentimes.
I totally agree with this. I have this talk all the time because you never know where the talent stops and the hard work starts. Sometimes it's different, you know, with some people, and sometimes the most talented people don't make the best music. That's the thing. It's a funny thing. If you think about like the Miles Davis Quartet, like Wynton Kelly was playing before, and he had this like incredible feel. The notes were popping off the piano, like with this blues sound, but people tend to think of Bill Evans more, where Bill was more introspective and he really worked really hard. Not that Wynton didn't, but they kind of think about Bill more, and it's a funny thing. You never know where that line is. But I think, you know, you can't go wrong really working hard.
No, that's the thing. There's just never, nothing's ever lost.
Right.
Nothing. Right. I mean, there's never a downside, you know, to putting in too much work.
Yep.
You know, I know you know Jim Campolongo.
Yes.
And if I told you this story, tell me to shut up. But I get an email from him one day at like 4:30 in the morning. And we spoke. And I'm like, dude, you know, what's up with that? And he goes, well, I like to get up because I could practice then. I'm like, wow. That was like, but that's why he plays, you know, it's not like he's been doing this 6 weeks. He's been doing this a long time, yet he's up at 4:30 clearing out his emails and spending 3 hours practicing. You know, that was really impressive, you know, and that's why he controls that guitar like, you know, not many people can. So, you know, it's you know, it's real simple. Whatever you put into it, you're going to get out of it. It's not like rocket science here, you know?
Yep.
Having done this for a while, if you could go back maybe and give advice to younger Gil Parris, what do you think you would have told yourself to make your life a little easier as a person or as a player?
Save. I came up when they were, so the budget for my first record was almost $100,000. And then I think we dropped down to 40. And I just remember, you know, there was just so much money. So I'd have like, you know, I'd fly in Harvey Mason to play, and, you know, I had like Bob James and Sanborn. And then, you know, if we were tracking, I'd have people come to the date and everybody would get lunch. And, you know, if I had known that the budgets were just going to go bye-bye for instrumentalists, I would have been a little more frugal, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, things have changed a lot, you know, since the post-internet music business is a lot different, you know?
But let me ask you this, though. You and I have spoken several times, and I never get any sense of like acrimony or bitterness about that from you. I mean, nobody in any industry wants to have to kill themselves harder. But the reality is, I mean, like my wife went to like Target last week and she said they're now delivering and this place is delivering. And I'm like, holy shit. And so everybody is basically, I think it's just like a new paradigm. The old days of, you know, making this, that's kind of gone to some extent. You know, it's a new shift and we're accepting lower margins and we realize we got to work more for it to basically keep up with Amazon.
Right. Well, see, the new paradigm is work harder for less. That's what it is.
Yeah.
When I came up, it was kind of special. I mean, I would have a bin card and my CD was there, it was in stores, and there was a difference between being a recording artist and everybody else. Now it's like the playing field is level, but it's too level. So, you know, supply and demand is out of control. And, you know, I think it was Jimmy Durante who said, now everybody wants in on the act. Well, yeah. You know, it's hard for venues. There are only so many gigs, and it's hard sometimes for venues to discern, well, this guy's, you know, a real musician, and this, you know, it's a difficult time. And I think as recording artists, it's extremely difficult now, because if you think about like great bands and great acts, whether it's like Tom Petty, it took him 4 records in to make Damn the Torpedoes, right? It mm-hmm. took him getting with Jimmy Iovine after a while. Bruce Springsteen, it took him, what, 3 records to make Born to Run? It took Led Zeppelin, what, 4 records to make Zeppelin 4, of course. So these are acts that every year they had big budgets. I mean, Zeppelin was living in a house. Like, you know, they had million-dollar budgets, and they could work on, you know, they weren't blogging, they were working on their social media, they weren't doing guitar setups and teaching Skype lessons, and you know, they were working at being Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
So now it's, everybody says, well, man, you know, there are no great bands. Well, there's no chance for great bands. You know, it's like there's only so much time in a day, you know, and you give a little bit of yourself away and a little bit of stuff, and then soon there's nothing left, you know. Yeah. There's only, so it's kind of it's kind of unfair, I feel, for, you know, younger acts where, you know, the internet and obviously the lowered payout rate from streaming and everything. I mean, it's, you know, it's very difficult.
Yeah. It's very interesting what you said, though. It's a really good point, I think, that, you know, Zeppelin needed 4 albums to make Led Zeppelin 4. I mean, let's face it, all three of them before that were amazing. So maybe they're not the best. Yep. But look, but the Tom Petty example is probably more valid.
You know? Right. And, well, look at Miles Davis. I mean, Kind of Blue was not his first record. He was right on Columbia. So it does, you know, it takes, art needs to be nurtured and developed.
Yeah.
And it's like we talked about before. And if you're worried about, you know, paying your car insurance and having to, like, you know, teach lessons and scramble around and do that's not working on the art.
Yeah.
That's work, you know, you know, and, you know, you can get sucked into like the whole social media thing and the instant gratification of, you know, you post your song and this is, but that's not really, you know, the way the old regime was. And right. I think the only people that are happy about the post-internet music business are people that never worked in the business before, you know, because they can kind of, you know, act like a recording artist and all that stuff. But it's, you know, you can't really make the killing you used to be able to make as a, you know, as an act that broke through.
Yeah. But like I said, I give you credit because you're just going out and doing your thing and you're working a lot. And, you know, I don't get any sense of, you know, yeah, it changed and it's not as good as it used to be, but you're pretty optimistic. I don't get any sense of bitterness or negative about you. Honestly, I think that takes some credit having come from. No, I do. I think, you know, I mean, look, it would be very easy to get like that, you know, about, you know, reminiscing, quote, about the old days. But man, it doesn't do anything. You know, I know, like, for me, looking backwards, there's never fucking anything good in that ever. ever. Right. It's never been a good upside to that.
Let's change the time and add some bourbon, and we'll see. But I'm kidding. But yeah, it's tough because I've seen the business from so many different angles, where a lot of people see it from just one.
Yeah.
And I've been called by Jazz Times to talk about the death of contemporary jazz, and I've been on some news programs, RNN and stuff, and some people kind of lash out when I give them, how it is.
Out at what?
Well, the fact that, I say it's, it's the post-internet music business is not... The people that love it, again, never worked in the real music business. Right. When I talk about the payouts and stuff for songwriters, like if you're a great songwriter that's not a live act, like let's say I'm trying to think of like Diane Warren or Bill LaBounty or I'm just thinking of great writers. If you're not going out and doing live dates, the payout that comes back to you from streaming is not it's not like you can't make a killing like you used to.
You can't even pay your rent.
Right.
Killing. Well,
and I see this happening. I landed a song on Japanese TV back in, I think it was like 2002. And the checks really helped me. It was a good quarterly payment. And then I talked to the Music Soups from the same show and they said, well, yeah, but now we take the publishing and it's a buyout. It's a flat rate, $500 to get the exposure of it. And I said, wait a second, it cost me $1,000 to make the track. Yeah. And this stuff is happening where, you start to see people who have their songs in film and TV and you think, wow, they've arrived. But there has to be a payout. And I think, one of the odd things now is following how to get paid. It's a little more difficult now where you had mechanical royalties back then, you had airplay royalties that now that stuff is drying up and it's that's why live performance is so important. I mean, ask Steve Lukather or somebody that had thriving studio and writing business and now he's on the road 200 days out of the year, and that's tough.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Let's talk about gear for a few minutes. As far as guitars, what would you say your go-to guitar is right now? And what other two guitars would round out your top three?
Well, obviously the signature guitar, for Reverend, and I like different incarnations of it for different reasons. I just used a Pete Anderson hollow body on a session that they make, that Reverend makes, that I really am digging. I was using an Artinger hollow body, Matt Artinger.
So you guy up in New York or something?
He's in Philly. He's an incredible builder. You'd love this guitar. It's sort of like a George Benson model, but with higher quality components, and of course I have a couple Strat Pluses from the late 80s that I think, since I was raised playing them, it's just sort of something fits in my hand, like it's sort of a part of me. So those are my go-tos. I use Taylors. I just shot a bunch of videos for Taylor guitars, and I'm good friends with Tim Godwin, and I work for them a lot. So
cool. Are there any cool stories behind how you acquired any of these guitars? Obviously, the Reverends, it's your signature model, but any of the other guitars?
Yeah, Billy Corgan from Smashing Pumpkins has a signature model for Reverend. But somehow, by mistake, they slapped one of my necks with my signature on it on his body and pickups, the signature. So a couple months ago, this arrives at my doorstep, this guitar, and it says it's the Gilly Corgan model. And I look in and they gave it. So it's a one of a kind and I really like it. I like the pickups a lot. So I've kind of been using that too. It's
the Gilly Corgan model. I like
that. Exactly.
Where are you living now?
I still live in Ardsley. I live in Westchester. It takes me about God, for like maybe 40 minutes to get to Iridium, and then all my gigs, like if I'm in Boston, 3 hours, and I'm playing a great theater called the Bijou this summer in Bridgeport. That's about maybe an hour and 10. So it's Daryl's house is an hour away. There are a lot of great venues. I like being, you know,
you hop Metro North takes you all over there?
Yeah. I mean, I drive a lot because it's, you know, parking usually included on a lot of hits, but it's so close and everything's right here and I'm sort of two blocks from the edge, you know?
No, I can't blame you. It's good to be like, plus, you know, living in the city is tough. It takes a lot of energy out of you. Forget about the cost. Even if you had the money for it, it's like, you know, I don't know. I love the city, but I don't know if I could live there. It's tough, man. It's a lot of energy takes a lot of energy out of you to manage that many, that tight of, you know, people.
Yep. You know? Yeah. And it's tougher now.
Oh my God. Yeah. Are there any players who influence your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
You know, I did an article for Guitar Player Magazine with Michael Brecker, the sax player, where I went to his place, rest in peace, where I was like fingering some of his sax lines and stuff. And I've always really been into those guys like David Sanborn. I'm mentioning other instrumentalists because I guess that's more of what I gravitate to. Although, I mean, there are guitar players that obviously have a big place in my heart, for like Cornell Dupree, Amos Garrett, Larry Carlton, Robin Ford, George Benson, that were a big part of, you know, the whole thing. But I tend to listen to other instrumentalists more, you know.
Well, Santana, I know, is a big influence on you as well. I've seen you play a lot of Santana stuff, and you do that, you know, what's it called? Picks the guitar hits. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I asked you to pick your, do you remember the Tower magazine?
I do.
That's Pulse. Right. Yeah, Pulse. Right.
I was in there a couple times.
Well, were you? I love that. That was such a cool magazine. And like, I remember I was like 11 or 12 the first time I'm in there, and I see this magazine. I'm like, is this free? And they're like, I'm like, oh my God, this is free. This is so freaking cool. But I asked you that because I think that's the first time I ever heard the Desert Island Disc expression. I mean, it might have existed other places. I'm sure it did, but that was my first exposure to it.
Yep.
I was curious if what your top three Desert Island discs would be in no particular order, and knowing that this can change tomorrow. Just curious what the first three CDs that come to mind right now.
I started out as a record collector, so I have, you know.
You have a lot of records still?
I mean, I have probably 20,000 here, so it's it's pretty crazy.
That's great, man. 20,000. Yeah, because your parents probably collected records too.
They, you know, my mother was so sort of hip, East Village. She would take me to all these shops, and I was able to get the like promo copies of for like 39 cents of everything that was coming out, and I mean, I have every record that Eric Gale and Cornell Dupree played on, everything George Benson played on. You know, I had to just get it. But if you were going to ask me, I don't know, top three. I mean, I remember being knocked out by, there's a record, Gated Dreams, by Klaus Ogerman. And the soloists are George Benson, David Sanborn, Mike Brecker, Joe Sample. And it's a beautiful record. It's like 35 minutes or something, and it's orchestral, but then he has these jazz soloists. And I tend to like records like that, that are really, they're easy to listen to, but it still has that depth. I like Christopher Cross's first record. I mean, it had Jay Graydon was playing guitar, and Larry Carlton, and Eric Johnson takes one of his first solos on there. And
I didn't know that.
Minstrel Gigolo was a tune where Eric plays, and it's one of his greatest recorded moments. I that record won Grammy for Record of the Year, And I still think that's a great record, you know. All of that kind of West Coast AOR stuff, you know, the stuff that Jay Graydon produced, so the musicianship is really beautiful. Everybody knows their place in the music.
I'm assuming you're a Steely Dan fan then?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course.
That's such a... every time I listen to them, I... Maybe because of the... I always think of Pretzel Logic when I... Yeah. Because that's like such a New York... You know, the pretzel dude that doesn't exist anymore, but that was so... Yeah. It's so funny that every time I see that album cover, every time I think of Steely Dan, that's the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, all their hits come to mind, but that cover of Pretzel Logic was so funny.
Yeah, I kind of like the fact that they have a New York thing and an L.A. thing. So, because I love the studio sound of both. That, you know, on one end you had Jeff Beccaro and Lukather and Jay Graydon and Abe Laboriel and Ernie Watts in the L.A. sound. And it was really beautiful, Rittenhour. And then also on the New York side you had Richard T. and, you know, and Gadd and... And of course, everybody mixed in with different scenes, but I love them both, yeah. You know, and that's how I really learned. Luckily, since I was doing like pro work early, I got to meet all those guys and kind of hang with Cornell. And I saw him on sessions. I saw Hiram on sessions. And, you know, it was a great thing to be around, you know.
All right, Gil. So. Let's get under the hood now and talk about you a little bit. Tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Oh, boy.
That's a tough question.
So, who writes these questions? So,
no idea.
You know, I joke with my girlfriend. I say it's Gil Paris's magnificent, wonderful, fantabulous ride. And it's kind of a – and she's like, oh, brother. But I joke about it because – I'm in this position where I live in New York and, you know, I meet a lot of people from different, you know, some very famous, some not, you know, I don't want to drop names, but I'm able to like kind of bring a lot of people together. And that's one thing I really love about, I guess more about the business, not just myself, but I like bringing people together. And I guess that, you know, that falls into that category.
You know what I respect that about you, because I think more people, myself included, should have more of that, like, hey, it's, you know, Craig Garber's wonderful ride, because really it's up to us, right?
Right.
You know, we only get one shot at this. It could be a wonderful ride. It could be, you know, some people just fucking miserable trip, you know? I like that a lot. I'm going to write that down, because that's why I like doing these interviews. I get free therapy.
Yeah.
Although I'll tell you a very funny thing. Do you know, you ever heard of the band Steel Panther?
It sounds familiar. Well, yeah.
They're a glam, they're a parody act. They're a glam, they're like a knockoff of the 80s glam metal bands, but they're like over the top exaggerated. And I interviewed Satchel, who's their guitar player. And, his response is, what he liked most about himself, just, I'm just so fucking good looking, man. I
mean, oh, you can mind.
Yeah. It was quite funny. How about the other side? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
You know what? I'm good. I wouldn't. I'm lucky. I had moral parents, and I think it rubbed off on me. So
cool. Best childhood memory. You sound like you probably have a lot of them too.
You know, when I went to, I was 17 when I went to Berkeley, and I got a jazz master scholarship, and really, like, I was playing a lot back then, and like I would play through like Joe Pass books, and I'd play through like stuff that was kind of heady for kids at the time, like, you know, like in. I was listening to heavy stuff when I was in high school, as well as, like, you know, rock stuff and Petty and Zeppelin. And I went to this ear training course, and Walter Beasley, who's now a friend of mine and I run into and do shows with, he was the teacher. And he slammed on this chord. It was like we were in beginning ear training, and he slammed on like a G13. And he said, if this is a G13, what's this? And then he hit a B minor 7 flat 5. And I just like jumped up because I, not that I had like the best ear in the world, but I knew what it was because I played it all the time. So I just, you know, said B minor 7 flat 5. And the whole class like fell out because it was like day one or two of ear training. And I thought, you know, that's really funny because I never thought I had such a great ear. But it came from a point of like, again, like what we talked about earlier, where does the gift end and the hard work start, and does, and I kind of felt like I was on the right track, you know, and Walter and I, it's funny, we laugh about it. So,
so that was like, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was like the universe almost like really validating your ongoing path here in a sense that in a way, right? I mean, that's how you, yeah, how you felt.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's funny that was so that's what I just, that comes to mind. Obviously, I mentioned you know, the whole guitar player thing, Spotlight, when I was a kid. But yeah, I ended up leaving Berklee. I got a touring gig. I was 17. I was gone for 3 months in Europe right after that, and I never went back. I feel like I've been working straight since then. Yeah,
but you have been. But great. You know, how many people would want to trade positions with you?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I've been a working musician, you know, for whatever, 30, 40 years or 30-something years anyway.
Yeah.
That's awesome. If you didn't – this is probably not a valid question. So I was going to say, if you wouldn't become a professional guitarist, what do you think you would have become? But I wouldn't imagine you could even answer that.
Yeah. I mean, I would say an actor just because that's what I grew up around.
Sure.
You know, with dad and stuff. So – But he wanted me to pursue it, you know. I always kind of find like I can be an actor with the instrument. You know, it's like you kind of,
yeah,
you're playing a role and speaking through that. And I kind of also take that approach to like when I'm putting on a show where I'm not just some jazz guy looking at my feet, you know, getting into the music, and that I like it to be an entertainment experience where, like, you know, you talk to the, I feel very comfortable talking to audiences. So and a lot of people don't. That's another thing I realized, which I guess is sort of like a gift.
Yeah.
It takes time, you know, and luckily I've been around people that Bill Boggs was
The talk show host,
you know, Bill.
Okay, yeah, because so, I loved it because I used to watch his show.
Yeah, right. Okay, so Midday and
yeah.
Corner Table with Bill. And I called him because I was doing
Didn't he pass away? No, he's still around? Okay, good.
So, I haven't seen him in ages, but anyway, I called him and I said, hey, you know, I'm doing this whole run of TV shows, and what do I do? What, you know, how? He said, well, he goes, just be yourself. People like you, and exude a little bit more energy than you normally would. Mm. Just a tad more upbeat. And I'll tell you, that's like the best advice I ever got. Because when I go back and watch videos, when I'm like Eeyore before that information, like, just like, you know, well, you know, I like to play. Yeah. And I think about that a lot, that little bit of advice where it's just like, just be a tad more upbeat. Like, hey, I'm here at Iridium. This is great. I'm in the greatest city in the world. Not, you know, not phony.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know,
just
come on and be part of this with me.
Yeah. You know, a few things. Can anybody be a successful entertainer now that cannot interact? I mean, I got to believe that would be really hard.
Yeah. You know, that's the funny thing. I talk about that a lot, too, because there are certain musicians I think about, like, I can't imagine, I don't know, Tom Harrell, the trumpet player, or like, I'm trying to think of somebody, Tom Waits or Miles Davis, somebody like blogging and doing like interactive videos with you, like, you know, Miles coming to your room and doing a lullaby house concert, you know?
Hey! You know?
So, yeah, but now there's this, you know, people want that that interaction. You know, so it's sort of like you had better get used to that if, you know, if you want to continue on this. You know, Chris Bode is a good friend of mine, the trumpet player, and he's like magnificent at, you know, just making you feel like you're the only person in the world when he talks to you and bringing the audiences in. And that's something to think about.
I don't think people want it. I think people crave it. I mean, honestly, I think it's like, I don't know how somebody could be a successful entertainer without letting people in.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And it's funny because that I got that same advice many, many, many years ago when I first got in sales. Someone said, he who has the most energy wins, which is the same, basically what Bill told you.
Yeah.
And I've always, you know, even like, I remember like I had a, if I was doing a webinar or a conference call in the evening and it was like 8 or 9 at night, and not that that's late, but you know, I'm up 5. So 9 o'clock, you know, I'm tired then, man. But I'd stand up and I'd always put like a yellow sticky with just said energy. And I always, that's so important, man, because people will, you know, absorb that and vibe off it for sure, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Mm.
You don't seem a little odd, to be honest with you. I'm sure you got a lot of odd shit, but you don't.
Well, let me say, I got like little stick-em notes everywhere. I'm very OCD. So, you know, that's probably, yeah. If I have to clean my strings after every gig. Before I put it, you know, if I'm in the gym and like I put the weights back facing up with the number on there, that's that kind of thing, you know, yeah. Where I have to, you know, everything like has to be sort of the same way. And that's a little weird trait.
Yeah, that's a little OCD. I had another guitar player's OCD, and his thing was he had to exert the same amount of pressure on the floor equally with each footstep.
Wow.
That's a fucking job, man.
Okay, so he's worse than I am.
Yeah,
okay.
And I'm like, so wait a minute. You're in the mall with your wife, and are your kids like, why is daddy way back over there? You know, he's busy, you know, because he'd have to redo his steps.
Right.
That was. Wow.
The show Monk. It's like
I know the show, but I've never watched it. But yeah, that I was like, man, wow, I really feel for you. I was like, you don't go out much, you know.
that's tough. That's no, tough. No, I'm certainly not at that level, but you know.
Yeah, that was that OCD stuff is bad, but you know that's a just a manifestation of anxiety.
Right.
Yeah. So we'll have another session to figure out where the anxiety is from. Is there anything that you're still interested in learning how to do?
Oh, sure.
Like what? Yeah.
God, I'm always shedding stuff. I picked up an old book, Walter Bishop Jr., this piano player. It's called the Theory of Fourths, and it's all these like different variations of atonal stuff, and he puts it in a concise way. I mean, I'm constantly looking for stuff, you know. My house is filled.
Anything outside of music that you're looking to get good at or learn how to do?
I mean, you know, I'm into the fitness thing, so I like to just keep going. It gives me that energy, you know. Sure. But no, besides that, it's just, you know, personal growth.
Very cool, man. Biggest business or personal win?
I'd say, I mean, if I'm really looking at the whole thing, I've always been able to make music and travel on other people's dime. Really? I mean, like that's these days that it's getting rare. It's like, again, I've had budgets for my records. For my live DVD, I was signed to a media company. You know, I had Paul Schaefer there and Bernie Williams and, you know, you know, I've always when I travel, it's taken care of by whoever I'm working for. And even if I travel on my own, if I'm touring on my own. So, yeah, I mean, to be able to create art and not be, you know, I get worried or leery about this whole crowdfunding thing, you know, this whole Kickstarter, like, because it gets to be like, tons of vanity projects. It's like the person with the biggest Italian family wins. If everybody, if Antonuk can give $10, then, you know, Grandpa McNeil, wait, it's a Jewish family. So everybody will give money. And then it just gets to the point of, like, what is the point of this project? You know, like, it was different when I got in because there was a huge separation between either you were signed and somebody gave you, that's what made you a professional, somebody who gives you money to create work. Like, now it's so bizarre, but I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, it wasn't like a vanity career.
No, for sure, man. And just for people to listen, check out Gil Paris. Just, he's too modest because he's got a whole bunch of other things that we really didn't talk about, but man, you should just spend some time researching him. He's a very diverse player who's had a career for 40 years now, a busy career, and he's still very busy now. In fact, he said he's busier now than he's been in the last, you know, 5 years before that. So, you know, I was kind of beating him up a little bit, like, man, you got to tell people what you do. But he's a little modest, but, you know, just check him out, please. Anyway, have you ever had a specific experience that changed your life or altered the way you think about things?
Yeah, well, back in 2001, when I was on the road with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, I flew into New York, and I was meeting a friend from the airport, and I went by this bar in Yonkers, and there were no words exchanged. I had my hands in my pockets, and somebody hit me from behind. It was like and I don't know if they were trying to mug me or what the impetus was, but there's been interviews and stuff where I talk about it. But what happened was I was knocked out cold, and when I fell back, I fell on my hand and I broke my finger, my index finger. So I lost the, we had a whole tour with the Doobies coming up. We were in Chicago for like 3 days, and I had to, you know, give up the gig. So I couldn't play for a while. And
it was your left hand?
Yeah, it was my left hand. Wow. So, you know, and my face was all swollen, and luckily,
did they rob you or anything?
No, luckily, like, you know, I heard some people screaming and stuff, so somebody came to help me, and then my friend came in and, you know, took me to the hospital and everything, and I was fine, but it was just the, you know, I couldn't play.
Yeah. So,
and that was just so bizarre, you know, to be like, I talked to Larry Carlton about it, because Larry went through something way worse than me, where he was shot. And I did a couple double bills with him later. You know, we did The Cutting Room. I can't remember what year that was, but we did like 4 shows in a row. So, and I talked to him about it, and like, he went through hell, and it was a weird time for me. But it's odd, because my mother had Alzheimer's. She got it right after that time, and when I was off, I was able to spend, like, you know, months with her, where we could just, you know, and then she got very ill, and then I ended up going back out on the road with this sax player, David Mann. So it's weird. I think it was like, I kind of think of it as God saying, hey, slow down a little bit, deal with your family, and then you'll be okay. And it all worked out, but it definitely changed my life.
So you would never have had to spend that time with your mom. That's like really good that happened then, effectively.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, you hear these things happen, and it's like maybe a mistaken identity. Maybe they thought you were someone else, is what it kind of – who
could be. I was – you know what they said, because I – you know, we went into some legal stuff after that, which ended up being thrown out. But I was dressed very nicely, and it was like a little seedy area, you know. And I probably should have been playing pool, but, you know, who knows?
Yeah, but they would have stole something from you. That's what I'm saying. The whole
Well, I think it went by too quickly. You know, I think, like, once I was hit, like, people jumped in.
Oh, and there wasn't any time to.
So there was no time to. Yeah. And I was wearing, like, a coat. I was all bundled up. So any wallet or anything was inside, you know. So.
Wow. That's. You know, wow. That's wow. Glad you got through that. All right. Holy shit.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
That is crazy. That is really weird. Good, nothing happened to you. And I'm glad you got to spend time with your mom, which is even more
important. Yeah, Yeah.
One last question, man. What has been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of this change was deliberate? And how much is just a natural part of aging?
Well, I mean, I guess recently would probably be the loss of both my parents was, you know, that's heavy to anybody.
Yeah.
But over the, I think the business has changed so much. It's very easy to, you know, I see guys very bitter about it. And I think part of that is that everybody wants in on the act, and the supply and demand is so crazy. And you've got people who are part timers, and they're taking work away from the professional guys. And I don't know. It hasn't made me that jaded. Where, like, you know, I still feel the same exuberance to, like, go out and perform. So in a lot of ways, I'm the same. You know, but there's a certain calmness to, you know, getting towards this age in the business. You know, and so I guess I'm in a good place.
Good, man. Let me tell people a little bit stuff about you, and then please chime in if I have to hit you over the head to do it, it seems like. first of all, Reverend has got a Guild Paris guitar, and it's one of their best-selling models. Want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that guitar player said it was one of the coolest artist signature guitars of all time, which along with Benson's Ibanez and Clapton Strat. So that was amazing, and it's quite an honor, and I love the company. I love Ken Haas and Penny, and Joe Naylor's a genius builder. So, and I like some of their other guitars too. So that's been terrific, and I'm proud to be with them, and I'm moving forward with doing more stuff with them. So clinics and videos, and so you'll be seeing more of that in the future.
Great. And aren't they revising your guitar now? There's another yep. model.
Yep. There's one in black with a roasted maple neck that comes out, I believe, in the summer this year.
Awesome. And where do they find Reverend deals? Just go to Reverend Guitar website?
Yeah. I mean, they're all over now. They're okay. Really, I mean, it's, they're really like moving up, and it's, I'm telling you, it's going to be like Gibson, Fender, and Reverend. They're really on it. So
where are those guitars made? Are they Indonesia, Korea, or China?
Korea, but they're everything set up over here, you know, and Joe is incredible. So everything coming out of there, the necks are very even, you know, you're not going to get anything that isn't playable. Everything is, you know, it's pretty amazing because they're competing with companies, I don't want to name names, yeah. but that are far bigger, that where with their price point, they're, you know, doing a lot better work.
I've talked to a couple of builders actually that are building in Korea, and they have really good quality standards there. Yeah.
They're,
you know, these yep. are guys, and I'm sure Reverend's the same way, that I've had existing relationships with these guys for a long time. So it's, and one of the things that, if I remember correctly, that was really impressive, that there's not a lot of turnover there in these factories. Like, you go in there and there's the same guys that have been building the same guitars for 12, 13, 14 years.
Right.
Which is, you know, very unlike the American. especially like Gibson, you know, you got people, who the hell knows where the hell on they're staying. Also got some stuff on True Fire. You got 50 Countrified Blues Licks, and you got a Smooth Jazz program.
Yeah, the Smooth Jazz one is a big seller. Surprising, isn't it? It's like, and, but really, you know, I mean, those are titles, but it's really an inside look into what I do, articulation wise and phrasing wise. I think each one of those courses is far more about overall musicality than just about licks. So when you get those packages and you open them up, like, I'm really, you know, I'm opening the doors to, like, stuff that I use live. Hmm. I mean, I can sometimes in the videos I'll mention, hey, go to this YouTube video and hear me playing this lick with Joe Cocker and hear where I lay it in the bar, or, you know, with Diane Schur or something. And this is the stuff that I use. Hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of watered down information out there, and I just can't present anything that's not something I'm using all the time.
You know? Now, you got a really good work ethic. I respect that about you, and I know that you're not bringing something 50% no matter what you're doing, you know. So right. That's really cool. Where else can people find you, man? How else can we put money in your pocket, Kill Powers?
Well, you know,
how do people know where you're playing?
Right, as of now, it's mostly Facebook. I mean, obviously, if you Google my name, like tour dates or something, will come up if I'm in the area, but like bands near me or something. But I know we just did Daryl's house. Tomorrow night we're at Treme in Long Island. We have a Iridium show on St. Patrick's Day with my girlfriend Jessie Lambiazzi that's singing for Women's History Month. It's going to be a great show. And then I have a whole weekend there picking the guitar hits in July.
Oh, you do? Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's going to be great. And then you got to come in for that. Come on.
I want to come.
I'll send the town car. So, and then we're doing like the Bijou Theater in Bridgeport. I mean, we're doing like theaters and some touring dates that mostly driving stuff, Rhode Island. I mean, luckily around this area, it's just incredible still. Mm. So,
well, it's incredible for you because you've networked. I mean, you got a big history there, man. It's like if somebody coming into New York, they might say, fuck, there's no clubs here anymore, and like go home.
You know? I know, I know. And believe me, I don't take it for granted. Yeah. I know. It's that. It's funny because people sometimes attach success with like, oh, they're on the road, they're touring, and I'm, you know, and I love the road, I love touring, but it's just, it's not, equation wise, it's not as great as it used to be because you know, flights are so double booked now, the price of rooms has gone up, and if I can do like a lot of damage around like the Rhode Island, Connecticut, Boston, New Jersey, Manhattan, it's, you know, I'm going to do it. And then when I get the LA hit, I'll go out there and do it. And, you know,
and hopefully you can stay out there for a month and at least make it worth your while or right. 2-3 weeks anyway. Exactly. Yeah. And bang up a bunch of, cool. And is any chance a Gil Paris website is in the future?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, coming soon, no doubt.
Well, once you get it up, let me know. I'll put it on my site, and then I'll announce it. So,
terrific.
Man, I can't thank you enough for your time. I really appreciate it. I'm really glad I got to connect with you. You're a super cool guy. I admire your work ethic, and I've admired your playing for a while. So, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for everything, man. And I wish you good luck with the new Reverend Guitar and all the other cool projects you're doing. And, man, I will. Hopefully you'll be playing around when I'm in town in May. I'll let you know when I'm coming in. Yeah. Everyone, great. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks very much again to Gil Paris. Check out Gil online. It's Gil Paris, P-A-R-R-I-S. And he's a real, man, he's just a good guy and a great player who really, he's put a lot of time in. And he also looks like he's about 25. I'm embarrassed that he's like almost my age and he looks like my son. Anyway, but it doesn't make him a bad person. Anyway, Gil, thanks for spending time with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg.
Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes along with early product announcements and discounts. And remember, happiness is a choice. So be nice, go play your guitar, choose wisely, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.